Hi, my name's Kristen.
And I'm Corey.
And this is Brainstorm. And today we're with... Oh, we didn't set him up. That would have been helpful.
You're not going to start over? I'm just going to give my bit?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Go for it.
Okay. Bill Miller, Icon Entertainment.
It's hard.
The face you're making is hard for me. This expectation.
I'll look away.
Bill Miller, Icon Entertainment.
Wow, and that nailed it. Yeah, it was you.
look away.
Yeah, I'm tongue-tied.
It was in the middle of the desert, so we always hiked. I loved reptiles, so I would hunt snakes and lizards. Before I started
hunting.
Were
there poisonous snakes?
Oh, yeah, rattlesnakes, scorpions, tarantulas.
Oh.
I wasn't afraid of any of those.
But your parents loved that.
Yeah, they did. You know, they were when I brought the first rattlesnake home, they weren't real thrilled.
But, oh, my gosh.
When you're in the middle of nowhere, I mean, what else are you going to do? You got to create whatever you can to create some excitement in your life. So I did that. And, it was a relatively normal childhood. There were probably, in my graduating class, there were 63 people.
Okay.
So that'll give you an idea how small it was. There was an elementary school, an intermediate school, and a high school, and that was it.
How many siblings did you have?
One.
Okay.
One brother.
Okay.
An older brother. And he also grew up there. So, you know, it was a fairly normal childhood, very Beaver Cleaver-like. My parents were, you know, middle class, and my dad was an executive with Kaiser, so we lived in a better house. They literally had company housing, and depending on where your status was in the company, that determined what kind of housing you got. And I remember, it's a long, long time ago, but still, it was $50 a month, which even then was like really, really cheap.
Yeah.
And that included all utilities. If your house needed painting, they would paint it. If you needed fertilizer and grass seed, they would deliver that. I think Kaiser Steel realized that to get people to want to stay in the middle of nowhere, they had to provide every amenity that anybody could possibly provide. So it was... Sure. It was, you know, sort of not reality, and just in terms of the way everything operated, because it was totally controlled by the company.
Yeah.
But again, it was a good place to grow up. Made a lot of good friends. When there's so few people, you know, you tend to all be sort of close, and there's a lot of camaraderie there. And you know, I see very few of my classmates anymore. Most of them or in other parts of the country, and they have the class reunion in Laughlin, Nevada, which is the last place on earth that I want to go. So they want to come to Nashville, a lot more to do here. So yeah. I've seen probably three or four since I've been here in Nashville.
Okay.
Wow.
Mainly the normal ones.
So what got you out of Eagle Mountain, California?
Well, you know, you graduate and you got to leave.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated, the mine, I think, was in the process of winding down, and my dad was literally the last person there.
Oh, wow.
So he was in charge of selling all the equipment. They had the largest dump truck in the world there, 350 tons. The tire wouldn't even fit in this room.
Good Lord.
So he stayed there till the very end. The day after I graduated, I got in a car and drove all the way to Nashville, Tennessee. As God is my witness. That was my first job. So Johnny Cash, who has been an important part of my life, introduced me to a TV producer who had just done a special on him called Johnny Cash, Riding the Rails, which won the Bronze International Film Festival Award, et cetera, et cetera. So he introduced me to this producer, and I think I was 17 when I first met her. I was 18 when I graduated and when I got in the car and drove all the way to Nashville. And I took my girlfriend with me. And so we drove all over across the country. And the TV show that I was to be associate producer on was called Grand Old Gospel Time, which emanated from the Grand Ole Opry.
Okay.
Jimmy Snow, who's the son of the famous country singer Hank Snow, who originally recorded I've Been Everywhere, was the pastor of Evangel Temple Church, where Johnny Cash went to church and Kris Kristofferson went to church, Connie Smith went to church, Larry Gatlin, the list goes on and on and on. So get there and arrive at the church, and I meet the producer, and I said, here we are, what do we do next? She said, well, I don't recall if I told you, but this is a volunteer unpaid job.
Oh.
So I'm 2,000 miles away from home. I've got, I think, $300 in my pocket. I think I filled my gas tank up, so I was okay in that way. So, you know, I was kind of speechless.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, you know, I don't have any place to stay. If I'm not going to be paid, you know, I'm not going to sleep in my car. I guess I'll go back. They said, well, why don't you just sleep here in the church in the basement until, you know, you can get things together. And I'm thinking, why should I get things together? You know, you enticed me to come out here. So girlfriend slept in one room. I slept in another room. And then one day the pastor, Jimmy Snow, comes to me and goes, you know, the flock here is very upset. You know, there's two unmarried people staying in this building, and it's about to cause a split in the church.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. You know, so I'm 18, and I'm going, okay, so I'm causing this church to split. So
that's way too much power.
I was pressured into getting married very quickly.
Wow.
So we went down, and I think in those days in Nashville, there were still blood tests and, you know, various tests you had to take to get the license. So got the license, and, you know, we really didn't know anybody other than Johnny Cash and a handful of people here. So June Carter Cash had an antique store, and she had antique jewelry and antiques and things like that. So I went over to look for a wedding ring, and I found a wedding ring I liked, but, you know, didn't have any money. I didn't tell them that, but I had no money.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I got back to the church, and this is before, you know, cell phones and all that. Got back to the church, and the church secretary said, Billy, I was called Billy Miller in those days. That's what Johnny called me until the day he passed away in June as well. Billy, there's a phone call for you. So I picked it up, and it was Johnny Cash's secretary. She said, I understand you were here, you know, looking at rings, and you liked one in particular. And she said, John wants you to have it, Cash. John wants you to have that. It's yours. And she said, but don't tell June. Don't say anything to you. So I got the ring, and, you know, that took care of that. And then Johnny had left town right after that. So Johnny's secretary, Irene Gibbs, who was an amazing woman, was my best woman at the wedding. And Jimmy Snow performed the wedding. I think there were, you know, maybe four people there other than me and my now ex-wife. I mean, how could that work? You know, we were forced into this.
Interesting, right? In order to prevent like a church schism,
living in luxury. I mean, this was a marriage that was, you know, doomed from the start, although it lasted 7 years. So here I'm in Nashville, and we start doing the show, and it was fantastic. And I'd always done photography as a hobby, and I was pretty good at it. Digital kind of killed my interest in it, because I really, when I took pictures, I would visualize. I could actually visualize a black and white image. And I was making pictures instead of taking pictures, especially because I was young and every click of the shutter cost money. You know, you had to buy film, then you have it processed. So I was very, very careful with that, but I was really good. So I'm here, and I've got no means of income. The church literally gave me a stack of Shoney's coupons for a free salad bar and a cheeseburger, which was really good. I mean, it was good stuff. But I know I needed to make money, you know, for other basic necessities. So I figured I'm in Nashville. There's a lot of concerts going on, a lot of events going on. So I called Irene Gibbs, who was my best woman at the wedding and Johnny's secretary. And I said, Irene, I said, you know, I need to make some money, and you know, I'd like to get backstage pass. And she said, okay. Well, she said, I could probably help with that. She said, which one? I said, all of them. Every one of them that happens, I need to take pictures. So anything that happens, I want to do. She goes, let me talk to John about that. So she calls back, and she says, come here in 2 days. John is sending something here to House of Cash, and it'll be ready to pick up. So I get there, and it's this handwritten letter on Johnny Cash's stationery, and it said, to whom it may concern, this is my friend Billy Miller. Please admit him backstage to your show with all courtesies extended on my behalf. Thank you very much, Johnny Cash. So when I walked up to any backstage pass with that letter, it's like, Go on in, sir. And I had unfettered access. I mean, I could go in the dressing room. Because, you know, when the artist heard about that, they go, must be a famous photographer or something. You know, this guy's got a letter from Johnny Cash that let him in. So I took pictures. The first show I did was Harry Chapin, Cats in the Cradle. You know, all grown men who have kids cry when the Cats in the Cradle start. Or that's supposedly what happens. I don't cry very often.
Might still happen.
But so I was very shy. And I think it was at Vanderbilt. And I was backstage, and it was very dark, and here he was sitting, and I'm back there, but I don't really know what to say to him. So he struck up a conversation with me. Very nice. All the concerts that he was doing at the time were charity, 100%, not even his expenses, 100% for charity. And he lived a very frugal life because everything he did was to benefit charity. And as a matter of fact, indirectly, that's how he was killed. He was run over by a truck when he was getting on a freeway in the cheapest Toyota Tercel or whatever he could buy, and getting on the freeway, couldn't pick enough speed, and that's how he was killed. Wow. So I remember photographing the show, and I kneeled down in front of the stage to take a picture, and I felt this puddle on my knee.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Don't love that.
And it smelled of Jack Daniels and vomit, and that's exactly what it was. So I had to spend the rest of the night with this smell on me, but I had to finish the job.
Oh, my God.
Now, thank God I'd already been backstage, or he probably, instead of engaging me in conversation, said, can you leave now?
Yeah.
So that was my first experience. And then I would find out whatever record label the artist was with, and I'd go and pitch the photos to them, and I was doing pretty good, you know. But again, I had the expense of buying the film, taking it to the lab, and then holding my breath for, 3 days, and then opening the envelope. And at that time, I was shooting primarily in black and white. I was shooting Tri-X, which makes prints. And then for most of the color stuff, it was all ektachrome or Kodachrome, which was slide film.
Okay.
So, I'd wait, and I'd go outside and look at that. That one looks pretty good. And then I'd make an appointment, and I'd go. And, sometimes they would buy one or two or all. And other times, maybe they wouldn't buy anything, or I couldn't get an appointment. But I remember I shot Waylon Jennings, and it was at the Grand Ole Opry building. And, the stage was very elaborate. It had the Flying W, which was his logo. The lighting was perfect, and I got, some of the greatest stuff I've ever taken at live concerts in my life there. Wow. And so I got an appointment with RCA Records and went there, and I had my black and white prints, and I had my color slide sheets. And he said, well, I'm really busy. Let me keep these for a couple days and come back, and we'll see what we're interested in. So I get a call from him, and I go back, and he says, we'd like to use this black and white one in the press kit. And he said, we'll pay you $50, which, even at that time, $50 wasn't a lot because, you had the film and the processing and everything else. So I said, that's fine. So that was, I think, the first sale I made. Now, I'm going to fast forward 3 years, and I'm in a record store, and I'm looking at albums, and it's a Waylon Jennings album. Beautiful color picture. And I go, that's my picture. I took that picture.
Wow.
And I bought the album, and I took it back and matched it perfectly to the transparency. So basically they, took one of my slides, duplicated, and then made an album with it. So again, I was very young still. I think I was approaching 21 at this time. So I called him up and I said, hey, you didn't tell me you were going to use that and you paid for the black and white image. And he said, I'll make you an offer. And I go, well, good. Big time. Album cover, Waylon Jennings. He was a big star. He said, okay, I'm caught. But he wasn't in any way apologetic. So his response was, okay, well, here's the options. I'll pay you $150 or you can sue me.
Huh?
That was it.
Yeah, wow.
So here I am, still eating those hamburger coupons probably. I'd progressed a little bit. So, that was my intro to the music business. And guess what? The music business is everything it appears to be. I think it's probably the dirtiest business in the world. I thought they screwed artists, but they also screwed young photographers.
Wow.
So that was my first, introduction to the music business when, you were on the wrong side of the bargaining table. And then I shot a lot. Hank Snow, who was the father of the guy that forced me to get married.
So romantic.
Thank you, Jimmy Snow. He's still alive, by the way. I love him. He's a good man. Having no idea that we would now fast forward actually be living in Nashville, that my three children would be living in Nashville, that I have two grandchildren in Nashville, and a family business in Nashville. Mm-hmm. It was the furthest thing that I could have ever expected. And it's still sort of surreal every day when I realize all of a sudden that, we have between musicians and magicians and staff, 800 people who rely on us for a living.
Yeah.
So it's still a little bit overwhelming, but I'm still having fun every day. And, 2 years ago, maybe a year ago, all three of my kids separately came to me and they said, Dad, it's time for you to stop and enjoy life. We have enough. Maybe we have too much. And I didn't respond. And then 6 months later, here comes my youngest son, Jordan. Dad, I got a project for you. and Blake, my eldest son, Will, is probably the most sensible of all of us. He's very stoic and staid and reasonable. And I expected him to resist the minute I said, this project's been brought to me. But I think they realize that that's how I stay alive, is to create. And, once we create something and launch it, I get bored very fast. The business aspects don't interest me anymore. There's enough money coming in to take care of all those 800 people and myself and Shannon. So it's not a money thing anymore. It's creating something that's compelling and exciting, and that we can have pride of ownership in. Mm-hmm. And we turn down huge deals all the time. I mean, the newest movement on Broadway is, the bro and cis country bars. It's to the point where every bar now has a contemporary celebrity attached to it.
Yep.
And, we're more into the legacy thing. I used to joke, it's probably poor taste, but I used to joke that, we only deal with dead celebrities because they don't talk back.
But
they have families, so we still get it. I'm kidding. We have a great relationship with all the estates that we deal with, the Sinatra estate, wonderful people, the Cash estate, the people who run the Cash estate are wonderful people, good relationships with the family there. So we've been fortunate to kind of pick right. But we've turned down a lot of deals. One of the biggest female artists in the history of country music, who's still a big deal, still sells out arenas.
Is she dating a football player?
Approached us. No, not that big. Nobody would say no to her. But I would probably make an exception because I'm kidding.
I think some country music fans would be offended at the category you just put this person
into. Well, she did initially start out in Nashville in country music, more of a modern country music, not the...
She did. She crossed over to...
Yes.
I think that's an interesting thing, too, because Johnny Cash, all his life, Johnny Cash is arguably... Well, Johnny Cash is the biggest country music artist of all time. There's no other country artist, living or dead, that has his reach still to this day. The Johnny Cash Museum has a higher census today than it did when we opened almost 11 years ago.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, last year we had our biggest day ever. And it was, I don't know how they could get that many people in that museum to generate those kind of dollars, but it was mind-boggling. But Johnny's reach and appeal is universal, but getting back to what you were just saying, Johnny was the last person to discourage or criticize any artist, regardless of the genre. When Billy Ray Cyrus came in, the old school country music people, look at this guy dancing around. He's got high top tennis shoes on. He's talking about the achy breaky art. He's not country. Look at him. And Johnny Cash, as a matter of fact, when Billy Ray was on Dancing with the Stars, pulled out a letter on the same stationery that Johnny Cash wrote my backstage thing on. And basically said, Billy Ray, don't listen to what anybody says. do what you do, go with your heart, and don't listen to anybody. And he carries that with him frequently.
He should.
Bob Dylan. I'm sure you've never heard of him.
No, who's that?
Who?
Back in the early 60s, there was I think they still have the Newport Folk Festival, I'm not sure, but Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and, you know, all the folk artists, and including Johnny Cash, would play the Newport Folk Festival. It was a big deal. So when Bob Dylan went on, could be the last time, he actually took an electric guitar on stage and was literally booed off stage. And the critics went after him. And everybody thought his career was over. So Johnny Cash, with nothing to gain, took full-page ads out in Billboard and Cashbox magazine and Record World. Those were all trade publications. I think Billboard's still around. I don't think Record World or Cashbox is. Took out a full-page ad. And with the message, Bob Dylan, to all you critics, shut up and let him sing. So the radio stations and the critics are all going, who the hell is Johnny Cash to tell us what to do? But Johnny respected all artists. And if somebody wanted to come in and call themselves a country singer and they didn't sound like country, who cares?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not hurting anyone else.
I think it's jealousy.
Yeah.
You know, Taylor Swift, country or not, she's the biggest phenomenon that the music industry's ever seen, mm-hmm. maybe ever will see. So I think it's petty for these people to pick, especially when other artists do it, because to me that's just showing insecurity and jealousy and nothing more.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there was a classic country artist, huge, who criticized her early on. She's not country. You know, well, so what?
Yeah.
So what? You know, her audience is different than yours. She's not going to steal any record sales. Mm-hmm. But my point is that Johnny was so inspirational to me because he was colorblind. He was genre blind. He was, you know, anything you could. He was the most tolerant person I've ever known and always there for the underdog. Maybe that's mm-hmm. why he wrote me the letter. He goes, Bill Miller, the underdog, living in the church, eating Shoney's cheeseburgers and salad
bar. Into marriage.
But... And you know, Johnny Cash is why we're here.
Yeah.
I knew Johnny most of my life, met him for the first time when I was 13.
Okay.
Fell in love with his music when I was 8 in Eagle Mountain, California.
Okay. You had no radio reception.
No. But when I discovered Johnny Cash, so I discovered him in the third grade. A girl brought Live at Folsom Prison to Show and Tell and put the record on.
It's racy.
And... I'd never heard him or of him before. And, you know, it opens up with this incredible instrumental opening. And then he says, hello, I'm Johnny Cash. I go, wow, I've never heard anything like that. And the record played for about 4 minutes and he started cussing. And the teacher ran to the, she hadn't heard it either. Back in those days, there was a thing called a tone arm with a needle on it that played the record. Tore that thing off. So I went home and I said to my parents, I said, you know, I just heard this guy named Johnny Cash. And they go, never heard of him. Because mom was into Wayne Newton and dad was into Bing Crosby and my brother was into Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. And I'd just been hunting lizards and snakes. I had no I had no interest in music at all. So again, we were in this small town, so I went to, it was they called it the Variety Mart, and there was a pharmacist in the back, and there was like dry goods and a small record section. So I found one record of Johnny Cash, and it was this compilation thing that, you know, they probably pressed 10 copies of, and I bought the fifth copy. The others are still probably there, because it wasn't very good. It was like, I think somebody licensed the songs that nobody else wanted put this album out, because I didn't recognize any of the songs. So I was very unsatisfied. So my parents were going to Indio, the big town. And I said, you know, can we go to the record shop there? And they said, okay. So I went in and there was Live at Folsom Prison. I go, can I have that? Yes. So I took it home and I remember I would close my bedroom door. And I had this record, this record player, Plasti, open the top and put it on there. And I had my hand on the door, and I turned it up really low because I knew if they heard, they're 8-year-old son listening to a guy who said, I can't forget the day I shot that bad bitch down. Or, you know, all the songs on that album, in one degree or other, pretty much dealt with violence.
Yeah.
And bad endings. So I figured if they heard that, that would be the end of my
be a bad ending
relationship with Johnny Cash. Very bad. Yeah. Yep. The record would be burned. I'd never be able to do that again. So about that time, that album really catapulted him into becoming the biggest recording artist in the world at that time. He was outselling the Beatles, the Beach Boys, Michael Jackson, the Jackson 5 combined.
Wow.
He was a phenomenon. He was the biggest star in the world. Then fast forward a couple of years, and the Johnny Cash ABC TV series happens. And that took him to another level. Mm-hmm. And it emanated from the Ryman Auditorium here. And his appeal and his influence and his integrity brought people to Nashville that had never been on TV before. So it was, you know, heartwarming to be able to do that. And we, as part of the website, there was limited merchandise on Johnny Cash, you know, 2 or 3 t-shirts, and, you know, we'd get excited if we sold 2 a week. Again, it wasn't for the money. And then Walk the Line came out.
Mm-hmm.
And within a week, we found ourselves packaging t-shirts almost 24/7.
Wow.
You know, we were probably doing $3,000 a year in t-shirts. Within 6 months of Walk the Line coming out, I think we tallied $450,000.
Oh my God.
We literally had the post office backing up to our garage with a truck to pick up these packages. And,
jeez.
And that wasn't even enough. So we'd make two or three. My middle son, Blake, worked with Shannon and I. He was our audio engineer. And packaging, you know, I'd print the labels and the invoices, and then Shannon would pick the stuff, and then Blake would package it and take it to the post office. But it became huge.
How accurate was Walk the Line? You know, because you, I mean, with intimate knowledge of him, mm-hmm. you know, going back yeah. so far, mm-hmm. how accurate was that?
I'm grateful for the movie. I mean, it was Hollywood. He was portrayed, in my opinion, a little bit as a hayseed. But he was probably one of the most intelligent, well-read, prolific people I've ever known. He was a Bible scholar. He had a degree in Bible. He could tell you anything about Revolutionary War or Civil War or Bible history.
Wow.
Very, very sophisticated. You know, for a guy who grew up in a town smaller than I did, mm-hmm. with a graduating class smaller than mine, he was very worldly. He was very, very intelligent. He could have a conversation with any president. He could have a conversation with Billy Graham. So I think that the movie accurately represented most things, but I think the portrayal of him as, you know, a man was a little bit hayseed-ish, if that's mm-hmm. a word.
So talk to us. So we kind of, at the very start, kind of left off with you driving away from Nashville.
Mm-hmm. Didn't look back either.
So what was your first entrepreneurial enterprise, if you will, and how did that get started?
I started as an entrepreneur when I was a kid in Eagle Mountain. I had the photography business.
Sure.
And mm-hmm. I actually stole the business away from National Portrait Photographers for the photography of my high school. There was this company that just went into every school, you know, they did all that stuff. So I took the contract from them. So photography was my first. I started that when I was 16 years old. That was my first dipping the toe into entrepreneurship. That was my first dipping in the toe into the water of entrepreneurship. Before that, you know, I was an industrious kid. I'd go up to the grocery store and I'd buy candy, and I'd take it to my house because the kids were too lazy to walk. And it was 130 degrees there sometimes in the summer. So I'd take it to my house, and, you know, if I bought it for a penny, I'd sell it for two. So I always had that, you know, in me. But I became the mayor of Corona, California, also in the 80s when I was 22 and served 12 years. And during that time, I was doing real estate development, which was kind of boring. You know, it's just something you made money at. And I was building a house at the same time. And a couple of months prior to that, I'd been to the Hard Rock Cafe in New York, the original one. And it was sort of in its infancy then. And I walked in and I saw, you know, Willie Nelson's dirty tennis shoes. But they were in this frame that made them look like the Mona Lisa. I mean, the way they framed these things, like, wow, this is incredible.
I have to have those.
Joan Jett's, you know, crunchy bandana wristband with an O-ring, you know, and they put it in a frame. It looked like art. So then, you know, then Buddy Holly's glasses, you know, Johnny Cash's boots. So made an impression on me. And then I was building this house and I thought, man, it'd kind of be cool to have some of this stuff in my house, you know? So I went to an autograph show that was being held nearby. And all these dealers were there with autographs and memorabilia, standing at these tables and having fun. And, you know, people are paying them for this stuff. And I thought, that looks really fun. I mean, that looks like a fun business because I've always collected things. So I'm a collector. And these people are actually making money at it and having fun. And look at all the cool stuff they get to buy and then sell and keep whatever they want. So I started a business called Odyssey Group and went out and originally, since I didn't have expertise in that, I would buy from really respected dealers. But obviously I'm paying, you know, retail less a small discount. So I had to get to the point where I was educated enough that I could buy from the same sources they were. So, you know, we had a good business for a year in that way. And then I, and you know, autograph authentication is truly an art more than it is a science. You know, I can tell you, not many contemporary celebrities, but I can tell you anybody from Marilyn Monroe to George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, John Wayne, if something's authentic or not. Picasso, et cetera.
That just from having seen
There are certain characteristics which are always present no matter what. Like I could show you five Johnny Cash autographs and you would just go, these don't look anything alike. Because in some cases, he could be signing on somebody's back, you know, in an audience. In some cases, he's signing a check. The serigraph that he did of Flight, he took precious time with each signature. It was perfect. Some people would look at that and go, that's not his signature. Because, you know, Johnny was always on the run. So it's like, Johnny Cash, these were beautiful. And they were in pencil, too. Try signing 350 pieces in pencil. It's not fun. And then try doing it so that each one's beautiful. So there are always certain characteristics present. And with Johnny Cash, there's one thing, and I don't want to tell anybody because then the forgers will know. There's one thing, if he writes a letter or a lyric or anything, there's one thing that will never, ever, ever, ever be there. And I've looked at thousands of handwritten pages and lyrics of Johnny Cash's. So
it sounds almost like forensic handwriting analysis.
Yes.
A little bit.
So we built a very successful company, published two magazines related to that. Then we started an auction house also related to that. Started being called on to do appraisals. We appraised every item in Dolly Parton's museum in Gatlinburg. We flew from California. Before the Country Music Hall of Fame made their move from Demumbrian to the present location, we appraised every item in their collection. And then Gerald Ford, as president, once asked me to appraise something. These were gifts from foreign dignitaries that he was getting.
So no big deal, just a president.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Chiang Kai-shek's gold pen, whatever it was. So I do these appraisals, and then all of a sudden, once I did two or three for free, all of a sudden I get dozens of requests from President Ford.
Wow.
Jeez. All the time. It looked good on the resume.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knew there was such a demand?
So then when he left office, I still was doing appraisals for the White House. But, you know, I was very busy and, you know, I would do it as a courtesy to a limited degree, but I couldn't spend all my time doing that. So I became, you know, pretty well known for being, the word expert is overused, an authority on these certain genres of autographs, historical, vintage entertainment. I didn't do contemporary entertainment because, again, when someone's alive, they can change their signature totally. So I stayed away from that. Sports, the sports industry at that time was, you know, under siege by the FBI of the forgeries. So never got involved in the sports industry. But as a collector, Johnny was also a collector, and we would send a catalog out, and one day I got an order from Johnny Cash. I said, this is my friend. I feel funny. You know, Johnny's giving me things. I said, I'm not going to take his money.
Yeah.
So I said, John, I'm not going to take your money. I'll send you this. You send me something.
You gave me all those Shoney's coupons back in the day.
That wasn't Johnny. That was Jimmy Snow.
Oh.
Johnny gave me the ring.
The ring, yeah.
Diamond ring, you know, so.
Yeah, that's.
Johnny was a little more generous.
What happened to that ring? Did it just.
You know, I don't know.
It was lost.
Three wives later, I have no idea. I know. Don't care. By this time, Nashville had pretty much been denuded of Johnny Cash. Barry Gibb bought the house on the lake, which was sort of the nirvana for fans. They would come from all over the world to see that house. Barry was restoring it. It burnt down like the last day of the restoration. House of Cash, which is where he had the Johnny Cash Museum and his publishing company and his offices, was sold and became office condos. Country Music Hall of Fame didn't appear to care because they had a Johnny Cash suit and a guitar like back in a corner, and there was like a 2x4 frame on the case.
Wow.
And we were doing the podcast, and people would write us emails all the time. They go, we're going to Nashville, whether it be from Czechoslovakia or, you know, Podunk, Arkansas. We're going to Nashville. Can you tell us all the Johnny Cash sites to see? Hmm. And I said to Shannon, you know, it's a shame that the only site they can see now is he and June's graves. He deserves better than that. So with no experience in museums and living 2,000 miles away, we opened a 3,000 square foot museum on 3rd Avenue South, and the museum was so successful that 18 months later, we took that 3,000 square foot space and bought the entire 27,000 square foot building.
Hmm. Wow.
And the rest is history. And you know, Inns Bank is our partner now on, I think, almost all our projects. You know, we have a great relationship. It was a risk, obviously, because, you know, nobody had ever done a House of Cards before. Nobody had done a Johnny Cash Museum before other than Johnny mm-hmm. himself. Nobody had ever, you know, done a lot of things. You know, House of Cards, no signs in the basement of the Johnny Cash Museum. It's a crazy concept.
But it's one of the coolest spots in Nashville.
Part of the appeal, though.
Well, but my point is that Inns took us on with some degree of risk and embraced what we did and still embraces what we do. And I consider, you know, you guys and Jim and Ellis and everybody family. And they've been very loyal to us. They support all our businesses, and, you know, we're loyal to them and very grateful. So I guess the moral of the story is that, you know, since we're doing an Inns podcast, I'd like to give...
We're doing a Bill Miller podcast. well, I mean, we just weren't able to get water bottles branded appropriately in time. We didn't know we needed to connect to Zach and Angela to get those.
You know, we're very cognizant, very appreciative of the fact that the partnership with Inns has helped us launch some of the crazy things we do. And you know, thank God they've all been successful. And Inns is a big part of my story.
Well, thank you for making the best espresso martini in Nashville at Sinatra's.
Thank you.
Just a casual plug there. The hint of raspberry is my favorite.
Didn't we have
part.
To cut you off last time? I got a call.
Did you?
So she's
it went all
Inns,
the way.
I saw you and Banks.
I saw
break
you
the
and Shannon sitting downstairs by the bar drinking an espresso martini too. So I feel like there wasn't. It was more
you
like
got
a
cut off first.
Cheers, not a cut.
And we'll draw the line.
And that's all for today. Thank you guys for watching this episode of Brainstorm.